Jennifer. I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'm a planner, and I'm pretty obsessive, and I like to organize my life. And I found out about speaking here about 6 weeks ago, and so it's been heavily on my mind about what I'm going to say, what I'm going to look like, what I'm going to feel like. Are you going to laugh? Are you going to, you know? So my ego is still present many years later. Congratulations to the person that took a year, Shannon, I believe is your name, and Raymond for 90 days, and any newcomers that are here. Welcome. I was thinking about my story, and, my aunt's here, right? My mom's sister. My mom's not with us anymore, and, you know, I probably wouldn't tell the whole truth if my mom was here. So, you know, I'm going to tell the whole truth, because I have my sponsor here, and I have women that I sponsor, my husband, and so I'm not going to try to make myself look better. I started drinking alcoholically when I was 11, and moved here. My mom was Scottish, my dad's Filipino, and we moved here. My dad was in the Navy when I was 11, and I found, you know, the right group of people right away. One of the gals named Barbara, and she liked to drink, and you know, that was not really anything that I, you know, had planned on doing. But that particular day that she and I met and started hanging out, we met up with a group of guys, you know. Go figure. I'm 11, meeting up with a group of guys. And they had rum. And they had a big, you know, bottle with a handle. And that's what we did. We sat and drank that huge bottle of rum. You know, that was the way we entertained ourselves. And then, you know, Barbara and I would go home and play Barbies. You know, like, up and down like that. You know, I would go drink alcoholically, and I would, you know, do the stupidest things. And then I would go home and, you know, do my homework, and I would get good grades. And that was kind of so symbolic of what was happening to me on the inside and what I showed on the outside. You know, there was always a discrepancy of how I felt on the inside and what I showed on the outside. And you know, I mean, that starting at 11 years old, I got sober at 22. I did a lot of damage to myself in the 11 years of drinking. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic family. My mom suffered terribly from this disease, and unfortunately couldn't get it. And you know, she's in a better place today. But you know, to see someone die from alcoholism, to see someone drink themselves to death, was a very painful experience. And I never really, even though I was sober at the time, I never really grasped that someone would die from drinking alcohol to that degree. And I apologize for my voice. I've had laryngitis up until yesterday. I didn't have a voice. So, excuse the scratchiness. But, you know, I was an approval-seeking child. I always wanted my parents to love me. I always wanted people to love me and appreciate and validate me. And, you know, my parents worked. I was a latchkey kid. I would come home and I'd do my chores and I'd do my homework and get good grades. And then, you know, I worked really hard during the week. So on the weekends, I'd go to TJ. And I hang out with Jenna and Barbara, and we would take a taxi down there, and I had a fake ID, girl named Raquel, and we looked pretty similar. And you know, we didn't have the check system that they do now, and we would go drinking bars every weekend. And Jenna's mom was a manager in one of the hotels, so we got into a lot of the bars, and I would find myself, you know, coming to on the side of a hill, you know, peeing and, you know, kissing some guy that I just met, and then getting taken home in some car, and, you know, nothing, thank God, nothing traumatic ever happened to me. I don't know how I survived that, but I did. But those were the risks that I took when I drank. And I'd come home, and I'd be the good girl, and my parents would say, you know, good job, you got good grades, and then I would be cheerleader. And then I went through this phase where I was hanging out with people in lowrider trucks, and I'd wear, you know, all black, and I had my hair out here, and Aquanet with, like, bowls, you know, I had to have Aquanet, and I was part of a group called Gel Jam, and, you know, it was like the first initial of everyone's name, and we were Gel Jam at Montgomery High School, and, you know, we thought we were something really special, and I look back at those pictures, and I'm horrified. I mean, we're, you know, our hair is out to here, and, you know, some of the things that I did, I, you know, I really thought I was pretty. I really thought that was, like, pretty. But I have to say, you know, like the 10-minute speaker, I never really felt a part of. There was always a part of me that felt less than, and I did everything I could to do what I thought you wanted me to be. I was a really good chameleon. And, you know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really got what you guys were saying. Emotionally, I got it, and, you know, I didn't want to fit in, but I knew I fit in. I didn't feel like I was separate from them. I was like, I don't want to be here. This is, like, I really hit the bottom of the barrel. Like, what am I doing here? Don't you know who I am? I mean, I'm Jennifer, and, you know, I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. My best thinking got me here, and I really heard a lot of hope in these rooms, and I heard people share their innermost thoughts, and the stuff that they would think would be the things that I would think, you know, and, you know, the insanity around my thinking, you know, about relationships. There's a page in the book, page 52, that talks about the symptoms of unmanageability. You know, trouble with personal relationships, praying, misery, and depression, not feeling of real help to anyone, a feeling of uselessness. I had all of that. And my relationships were, you know, were chaotic. I started dating when I was, you know, well, I didn't date. I never dated. I took hostages. I took for mine and all mine. And, you know, we had a very serious relationship at 13. You know, I dated Jeff until I was 16. And, you know, we drank and there was fighting. And, it was, you know, it was just nasty. It was a horrible life. So that's all I knew how to do. I didn't know how to be emotionally available for anybody. When I think back, I was 13 years old going to teaching, 13 years old in a 3-year relationship. I mean, I had no sense of what it was like to be a 13-year-old girl, and with the exception of going home and playing, you know, parties and that sort of thing, like I said earlier. I never wanted to be home, truthfully. I never really wanted to be at home. There were many times that I would take my mom off the couch and pour her in the bed. And there are many times that I would find alcohol in the drawers, and I would find bottles under the bed, and I knew there was a problem. I knew there was a big problem, and nobody was talking about it. And my dad, my mom and dad worked their butts off. They were immigrants. You know, they came here and they built a life for themselves, and they provided so well for me and my brother. We were working class, but my dad grew up on a dirt floor. You know, my mom, she worked her butt off. She had a very strong work ethic, and I get that from my parents. And it took me a long time to forgive my mom and dad for being who they are. And truthfully, it wasn't until my mom died, until I really began the healing process of forgiving her for being an unavailable mother because of her alcoholism. And, you know, I just remember a time when I used to always kiss my mom and dad goodnight. I would, you know, run up to them, give them a big hug, and give them a kiss goodnight. And I remember about 10 years old, right before I moved here, where my mom stopped saying I love you before I go to bed at night. And if I would say I love her, it would be like in a random moment. But every night we used to do that, and I remember when she stopped saying that. And the disconnect that I started to feel, and the alcohol that used to fill the space of the home, and the sadness that I'd walk into. So I filled my life with activity, and I was a super overachiever. You know, I would like I said, do cheerleading, and I was part of different clubs, and I was a peer counselor, and, you know, I was always pretending that I had it together. And on the inside, I was really starting to suffer. So I decided that, I'm going to go away to college. And I really didn't go that far. I just went to San Diego State. And I had big dreams of going, to the East Coast and being Ivy League. And I ended up going to San Diego State. And I couldn't wait to get out of the house. I was like, how do I sign up for dorms? How do I do this? So I ended up joining a sorority. So, I think about all the different phases I went through. I mean, kind of a little gangbanger and a cheerleader and, the high hair girl. And now I'm in a sorority. And so I'm switching myself again. And I don't know if you know anything about sororities, but you would, go around to each house and sell yourself. And, I sold myself. And I found the group that partied the hardiest. And, they were fun. I mean, it was a great time. I had a great time in college. I loved how they drank. I really loved how they partied. They would do things like, we would go to our house, we'd go to a hotel room on the beach, and we'd get really drunk, and then somebody would carry us home, or we'd go out on the beach, and we'd be throwing up, and we'd talk about it the next day, and, it was just like, we really bonded. And the sorority life was fun, and then we'd have the pictures, where we go like this, and we have beard in our hands, and I remember I almost got an MIP. I had my license that kind of looked like me, and I had an open container, and he was looking at me, it was dark, and I just remember thinking, please don't. And he let me go. I had these little, so many times when I escaped those major consequences. I never got thrown in jail, thank God. I never got a DUI or, killed somebody. But sorority time was really, an exciting time for me. I mean, I wasn't thinking about traveling the world. I wasn't thinking about, really being of service to anybody. I really wanted to just drink. And I would show up, do my classes, and, we'd go and have our, Salmon House and TV. I remember the Salmon House. And it was dollar shot night, and I bought 10 for me. And I drank. I don't know how many I drank, but I don't remember the rest of the night. And I got carried out by Allison, and I went up into the sorority house on the deck, and I guess I lit a cigarette, and I fell asleep with a cigarette in my mouth, and Allison came and found me the next day. That was kind of the first time that somebody had complained about my drinking. That somebody was saying, Jen, what you did last night, I'm tired of carrying you out of bars. I didn't know I'd been carried out before. But I guess I had, I'm tired of carrying a lot of bars, and this is getting really frustrating. And I thought, tight, fun. And I did the 5-year plan at San Diego State. So that last year, my class was beginning to graduate and move on. Like you do, you get a degree and you go get a job and you move on. And that last year, I didn't have enough credits, and I decided that I was going to do a fifth year and I would stay in the house. And what I looking back now, I was just definitely afraid of growing up. And that last year, I got in a relationship. Let me back up. There was a period of time I didn't drink for about a year. Smoked a little pot. A little ecstasy, and just a little. And then, but I didn't drink, and I was really not going to drink because my mom's drinking was taking off. And I was saying to myself, there's no way I'm going to end up like an alcoholic. I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that to myself. So I meet a guy named Matt, and Matt was crazy. I mean, he was a crazy partier. And he moved to Sacramento, and I decided to fly up there. It was our first date. So I flew to Sacramento, and I hadn't drank in almost a year. And that night, I drank. With all my firm resolutions about I'm not going to do this, and I was, I really felt like kind of holier than thou. I got it together, and I'm going to drink. And he brought it out, he didn't. I brought it out of me. I mean, the circumstances were that I wanted to be connected to him, and the only way I knew how to do it was to drink. And that sent me on a year-long binge. that took me down some pretty ugly paths. And where I, you know, ended up was in the employment assistance program, saying to the lady, you know, I mean, you know the details. I mean, just think about it. Me and the guy drinking all year long. I mean, it was crazy. I was doing really stupid things. And where it ended up was I felt really depressed at the end of that year. And I made a phone call to the EAP, and they invited me to come in. And I met with this woman named Susan. She was a social worker. And she asked me, you know, what's going on? I said, you know, I'm feeling pretty down, and I think that's depression. And so she started to ask me the 20 questions. Now, I don't see that I'm an alcoholic. I don't believe I'm an alcoholic, so why would I lie? So I answered very honestly, and I answered yes to many of those questions. And she said, well, I really think you need to go check out these meetings, these AA meetings. And I thought, she's really got it wrong. She didn't hear me. I have a little bit of depression. And yes, I drink, but they don't relate. And she was like, why? She said, you know, my mom's the alcoholic. I'm not. I've lived with it. I know I don't drink like that. I know that that's not my problem. I think I just need some therapy. So she said, okay, well, actually, I would really like you to go to an outpatient program. And I'm like, you've got to be effing kidding me. I cannot imagine. Why would you want me to go to an outpatient program? And she said, you know what? I want you to go because I want you to learn about your mom's disease. And I go, huh, well, I will do that. I will learn about her disease. So at that time, a guy named Mike that I dated, and he came back in my life. God is just so perfect. But the hand of God has been in my whole story, I mean, so many times. And I look back and I think, God, you have just cradled me this whole time. So he called me and he said, what's going on? I thought he was just kind of chatting. And I just opened up to him and said, I've been asked to go to an outpatient program. And I think it's really bizarre. Like, what am I going to do? Say I'm an alcoholic? Something. He's like, I have 90 days. He's like, we should go to a meeting. And I said, okay, I'll go and support you. So we went to a meeting on Draper Street. And I at the end we all held hands and thought that was really weird, and I was very cautious about that. And there was this really cute guy standing next to me and his girlfriend. And then Mike was standing here, and I thought, okay, that's really cute, you know. And I remember he came over and he said, oh, you know, hi, I don't even remember his name. John, you know, I'm nice to meet you. You know, how much do you have? I said, oh, I'm not an alcoholic. So, okay. And he moved on. I'm like, what the hell was that about? In my mind, was like, you're not paying attention to me. And, you know, that guy was with another woman, and he was moving on to the person that was an alcoholic. And I remember leaving there feeling really sick to my stomach. And I kept saying, I get what people are saying, but I didn't. You know, alcoholics are people with brown paper bags and waking up in ditches, and I have a degree, and, you know, that's not me. So he says, okay, well, let's go to another meeting. So I go to La Jolla, not La Jolla Speakers, but there's one in a small room. I don't remember what that was. So I go, and I hear this guy named Kevin. I'm sure some of you have come across him. He has a ponytail. He was in the military for a long time. And he got up, and he was giving somebody a kick, and he said, you know, normal people don't come to AA. And I said this before, I was really offended. What do you mean? I'm here. And I walked away that night with something like, I'm getting what people are saying, but I just can't possibly be an alcoholic. So Mike's still in the picture, and, you know, we're sort of kind of dating, and I'm feeling weird about it, and I'm thinking maybe I'm an alcoholic. See, but there's a great meeting in Mission Valley. It's called Trunks Only. And really, you gotta go. There are a lot of lawyers and doctors that go there. And I thought, okay, that's the kind of crowd I want to run around with. So, you know, I got there, and I don't know who the doctor or who the lawyer. I mean, you know, we're all just sitting together, and I'm sitting in the back, and everybody across is on, and just come from work, and I ended up going to that meeting a lot, and I spent a lot of my first few years of sobriety, probably my first 5 years of sobriety, pretty much going, you know, 3 or 4 times a week, and I loved that group. That group was so solid, and I left, you know, it moved to a place, I don't know, Jack in the Box, up Mission Road, and then it moved somewhere else, and at that time, I had about 90 days. And so, you know, my radar's up, and I'm manhunting. And, you know, I get a little bit of that clarity. I'm like, okay, I think I might have an alcohol problem. There is probably a problem here. You know, I go to a meeting, and then I remember seeing a guy, and he was wearing a polo shirt and his jeans. He said he was in law school. I'm like, oh, there he is. There's a lawyer. So, funny enough, I've been married to that man for 12 years. He's a newcomer, you know, I guess there aren't any musts, although I find a lot of musts in the big book, but I don't think it says you shouldn't date in the first year, but you probably shouldn't. It's really complicated things, and, you know, I was 90. Days sober, my husband was 7 years, but we won't talk about that. And we ended up, you know, on a date, and it's stuck ever since. And, you know, he was my hostage that he didn't know. And you know, we got along. We got along really well, and I really felt comfortable with Will. And, you know, and that's when my sobriety journey, you know, that's the beginning of it. And I spent a lot of time being in relationship with Will, but going to meetings and having Annie as my sponsor for the first 5 years. And we really kept our program separate. And I had a home group, and I went to meetings sometimes twice a day. And my life started to change. It started to get better. You know, I left a job that was part-time, and I started to get sober. I started applying to grad school, and then I realized, you know what, I can't do grad school right now. I'm so sick. I've got a lot going on. I'm so tired. I am so exhausted by all this. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not ever going to drink again. You know, my sponsor said, just for today. You know, don't drink between meetings. Don't, you know, wait for the miracle to happen. And I meet at her house, and every week we go to her house, we'll go get coffee at Starbucks. And Annie was just like, you know, she still is so special. She forever has a really, really warm place in my heart. And she's now living in San Francisco. But she's the first woman that I really trusted with everything. And, you know, I went to her house and I was so disconnected from everything. I was up in my head. I hated who I was. I hated how I was feeling. And we were preparing lunch and she said, okay, you do this. You cut the tomato. And I remember looking at the tomato and the knife and I said, well, how do I cut it? And she said, any way you want. And that's how lost I was. I couldn't even cut the tomato. I felt so inadequate and so lost and bereft of any kind of, you know, solid. I felt empty, that black hole just ate me alive. And it got better, you know, it started to get better with lots of meetings, working the steps, and, you know, going to dances and becoming social. And I never really developed friendships. You know, Will was my best friend. And we would do things with other people, but I never really branched out. And you know, my story is what it is, but I didn't know how to relate to other women. And, you know, because women were my competition. So if you had something that was even slightly better than what I had, I was going to get it. And I was going to do better. And there wasn't enough to go around. And, you know, you're taking away from me. So it was really hard to let myself open up to women my age or just be around women in general. I mean, anyone that was even slightly pretty was like, you know, a threat. So Annie, you know, gently guided me to a safe place. And then when she left and moved with, you know, to explore the world and, you know, do what she needed to do, kind of fell flat. I fell a little bit. And I got a sponsee at that time, Joanna, and she's here tonight. And, you know, that was about 5 years of sobriety. And prior to that, I started to bottom out at 3 years. I started saying, you know, happy, joyous, and free. I'm so not that. I'm so not happy, joyous, and free. This is really hard. I'm not feeling like my life's getting better. I work this desk. I'm going to meetings, and how come I still feel like this? And I didn't want to drink. That wasn't the issue. The obsession was removed. But I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay. So at this time, I was living in Solana Beach, and I started to go to meetings, and I met a woman named Sheila, who's my sponsor today, and she's here tonight as well. And we became friends, and I remember going to some of the meetings there, and I still wasn't feeling it. And she offered to take me through the big book, and I said, no, thank you. You know, I'm good. I'm dying on the inside. And then we ended up moving to downtown, and Sheila moved on, you know. She moved on to work with newcomers, and we were laughing about this at dinner tonight, and I was really mad at her. Because, you know, she left that group, and she needed to go and do what she needed to do to enlarge her spiritual life. And, you know, there was a jealousy of her doing that, and but I wasn't willing. You know, I mean, that's kind of the story of my life. It's like, I coveted what you had, but I didn't want to do the work. And so I got into a place of pain, and I just started this big book study, The Woman in Helen, and she gave me the greatest gift. I left that big book study about, I don't know, a quarter way into it, because I said, this is just insane. You guys are making me do an awful lot of work. And my sponsor never made me do it like this. So I left that big book study. And it was right around year four, that I jumped in because I was in enough pain. I'm like, okay, enough is enough. You know, I really, you know, keep telling me the solutions in the big book, and I read it, but Helen so kindly said to me, you know, the problem of the alcoholic is in the mind. You know, your symptom is your drinking. And your mind got you here, and your mind interpreted the book. There's a problem. So she took me through the book, you know, detail by detail. She worked my butt off. You know, she challenged me. And, you know, it was a very short-lived sponsorship, but she gave me one of the greatest tools. And to this day, that is where that is like the heart of my program is sharing that message with other women and taking the women through the book word for word and doing a thorough investigation of their alcoholism. So, you know, Helen was in my life exactly when she needed to be. And I didn't need the soft sponsor, the nurturing sponsor anymore. I need somebody who's like, your ego's too big for you. You need better get working the steps, and you better listen, or you're going to drink again. That's the bottom line. That's what's waiting for you. Jails, institutions are done. You make your choice. You know, and Jessica and I laughed about this. It's like, we're the only people who debate that. Like, spiritual help or jails, institutions are done. I guess I'll take spiritual help. And so then I got, you know, this sponsee, and I'm taking her through the book, and, you know, we become friends, and, you know, we're navigating that relationship. And she was really like my first friend in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she stuck around for a long time. And it's great, you know, I love it. We're really good friends. We've managed to have the friendship and the sponsor relationship. And when Helen and I didn't work out, you know, the only person I could think about sponsoring was Sheila. And, you know, Sheila had what I wanted and continued to have what I wanted. And it's just an incredible blessing in my life. So we got to working the steps and, you know, started to realize how powerless I really was and the unmanageability of my life at that time. And looking at the insanity, and I had a lot of insanity around my marriage. A lot of, you know, like, managing his behavior and trying to control the emotional nature of Will, and that's what I did, and it was causing me a lot of insanity. And then we had kids, I never wanted kids. I told Will, we're not having children, and he was cool with that. And then right when I turned about 30, I was like, I think I want a baby. So we went on this baby thing, and I had a miscarriage. And that was like one of my big losses. And I was so attached to that baby that I remember sobbing and thinking, God, that was life inside of me, and I lost it. And I just kind of sank into a depression at that time. So that was November. And then January, my mom died. And she died a horrible death of alcoholism. And so I was really depressed around this time. Back-to-back losses. And the thing about it is that there wasn't an issue of wanting to drink. But, I certainly was feeling, where it says in the bottom of page 14, for if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge her spiritual life, she will surely drink. Something along those lines. And I knew somehow that I needed to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life at that time, that amount of loss. It could have been really easy to get on a pity pod. And so I got pregnant again in July, and we had our beautiful son. He's now 6, and thank you. He's great. He's just a kick. He's really, really, really something special. But I guess every mom said that about their kids. And then after I had the baby, I had postpartum depression, and I didn't want the baby. And I thought, I don't know what to do with him. I felt horrible. I didn't have a connection to him, and I had this traumatic birth, and I thought, God, why? Can I return him? Like, what can I do? it was really, really an adjustment for me. And I remember staying up night after night after night. Like, I didn't want to sleep because every little, anything he did, I jumped and I was startled. And I got really sick. I got really sick with postpartum. So that took about a year to overcome that, and thank God for outside help, because that really saved me. And I remember Sheila coming with her kid and with her little son Luke and playing ball in the backyard, and just thinking, God, I can't even hold this baby. And she's out playing with the kids and having a great time, and it was a really difficult period of time. So I got through that. I decided to go back in. I got my master's at some point, and that was great. I was always competing with my husband because he had a higher degree, and I didn't want him to have one up on me. So I definitely went back and got my. He didn't know that, I don't think. But we're not having kids until I get my master's degree. Because I just wasn't going to be less than. Serious issues with that kind of stuff. So, thank God for the program, because I really have come to the right side many years later. So fast forward a little bit. I'm in my career. Jack's born. Get through that. I start sponsoring a lot of women, and it's like just this big mushroom effect, and my life is like, oh my God, it's so great, and the women are amazing, and many of them are here tonight, and I love women today. I can see how pretty they look and not be like under my breath going, really mean how beautiful they look and be happy, like, oh, you bought a house, and not going, what kind of house? You know what I'm saying. So in 2006, my husband got a job. It was a really, really stressful job. We were fighting a lot. He was, coming home stressed out every night. And I got pregnant in March of 2007. He lost his job in May, and we just bought a house. So, I had to come to that place. Like, all that matters is my sobriety. I have my health, sobriety. We lose this house, we lose sex. I mean, you know, whatever. I didn't really feel that way, but, you know, I really May, and then in July, my husband got a great job. Our anniversary is July 11th, and he was offered this amazing position. He's still there today. God just gave us, handed us greatest gifts. Anyway, got this great job on our anniversary, July 11th. So I was like, oh, things are really, really happy, blah, 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 blah. And I think it was shortly after that or right before that, I can't remember. I think right after that, my husband peed blood. So, we go into denial. And we go into denial and think like, okay, go get that taken care of, That job was blood, I had to go to the doctor, so I don't know how long it took for you to do that, but, it took a while, and he gets in, and they go through a battery test, and the cytology comes back, not good. That's like when they spin down your pee and analyze it, and it tells you if you have bad cells or not. So, he had bad cells. And then they do the scan, and they do this big machine thing, and they x-ray him, and like, oh yeah, you have this big thing in your bladder. But it could just be the shape of your bladder, so we need to go in, and we need to go look at it. So, the doctor says, if it's a short amount within an hour, it's probably good news. So, I'm really big at this time, and go to the hospital, and he called me at about, 55 minutes. I'm like, yes. It's not cancer. So he says, he gets on the phone and says, I'm sorry to tell you, but it is cancer. He has a huge tumor. And I just remember my world crashing down at that moment and sobbing in the hospital. And his brother was with me and we were just crying together. And I just thought, why? Why, God? This was like one of those moments of like, why me? And I remember going home from the surgery that night, and he was going to be in the hospital for a couple of nights. And it was like he had already died. And I was in bed, and I remember hugging his pillow. When you hear about people when they die, and they smell their clothes. And I was smelling his pillow. And I was thinking, oh God, I have a baby coming, and I have a 6 or 4 year old son, please. I'll take my spouse. And that really changed our life. It really just narrowed in on what was important, and really that's what I didn't care about. The health really didn't, and all I wanted was healing for him. And so I remember getting up and having play with my son Jack, and where's daddy, and he'll be home, and and inside just feeling that really sick feeling. And then 5 minutes. Okay. So what ended up happening is we went through a series of treatment. It was a 50-50 treatment. But this particular thing that he did, it didn't work. So that was really devastating. So, in my mind, at that time, I just worked harder and harder and harder with the women I was sponsoring, because that's all I knew how to do to keep myself out of my head. And I kept getting more spunky. And it was exactly what I needed. So, November, I had the baby. And I had another C-section, and I'm in the hospital. And I go home about 4 days later. And I wake up in the middle of the night, and I'm shaking terribly, and I'm really cold, and I'm thinking, okay, I can't move. I have a baby in my arms. Will sleeping in the other room because I was at work the next day. I'm getting up, trying to breastfeed, and all that stuff that happens when you're with a newborn. My second son is Miles, and he's awesome too. Really, really sweet. My son, my 4-year-old son at the time, comes in the room at 11 o'clock at night, and he's like, "Mom, what's going on?" And my son never wakes up in the middle of the night. And I said, "Can you go get your dad? I'm really cold." So he goes in the room and he doesn't get well. He just lays down with him. So I'm like, "Okay, well, at least he's awake." So I start yelling the old name. He comes and he's like, "What's going on?" I'm like, "I'm freezing. Can you put a blanket on me?" He's like, "It's 80 degrees in here." So anyway, he puts, Miles back to bed, and I'm asking him to look at the medication. Maybe I'm having an allergic reaction or something. And Jack comes back in the room. "Mom," I'm like, "go to bed. You know, like, I need to feed this baby. You're up, and I'm going to have to work with you tomorrow, and I'm going to be so tired." And he kept getting up from his bed. So I get up, and I walk him back, and I can't breathe. So send back to bed. He finally goes to bed. The doctor that I am, I thought, "I'm definitely having an allergic reaction. I go take a Benadryl." Okay, so fast forward. I'm in the hospital that night. The doctor says, "Come to the hospital. I have a pulmonary embolism," which is really bad. Blood clots in the lung. Could have gone right in my heart. So at that moment, Aunt Betty had the baby. She was trying to feed the baby. She actually put the liner in the bottle, and the whole formula went through it. I'm like, "Oh my God." You know, they hadn't told me yet, and then they come in, and the doctor says, "I'm Dr. Hanau, and you couldn't breathe tonight, right?" And I said, "No, I couldn't breathe." And she says, "You have a life-threatening illness, and you're not going home." And I said, I was so dumbfounded, and I remember she walked away, and they were like scurrying, and they were getting me shots and doing all this stuff. And I remember they closed the curtain, and I was begging God for my life. Saying, "God, I'll do anything. I'll do anything. Please. Don't take me tonight. Please. Don't take me. Please. I want to see my kids. I want to see my husband. I don't want to die." So, that was about 5 days of total surrender. And what I walked away with is that I knew that God had me, that I was truly powerless, and that I really came to believe that God would do for me what I could not do for myself. And he's done that all throughout my sobriety. And I'm healthy today. Things are good. My kids are great. Just to give you the end story, my husband, he ended up having to have his bladder fully removed. And I thought that is the absolute worst possible thing that can happen. And how that all lined up, the hand of God is there too. And I was, turning it over, and "Okay, God, we're not in charge of this either." Built him a new bladder out of his bowel, all this stuff. And I was like, "Oh my God." And everything worked. If you work on a left hand, you're like, "Kenny, no." So anyway, the doctor that lined up for him had nothing to do with us. No one we knew. The doctor, we knew one doctor, and he saw a guy in the parking lot who was the head of surgery, who he met and said, "Hey, do you happen to know the urologist that could do this?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, you got to call Carol Salem." So we called Carol Salem. We get an appointment that day because we mentioned that doctor's name. The whole thing just unfolded without any of my doing. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has been like for me. It's like I show up, I do the next indicated step, and the rest falls into place. And the steps were the ways in which I learned how to do that. I had to get clean within myself. I had to be willing to look at my character defects. I had to humble myself, and I'm a very prideful person, and this has been a very humbling process, to know that I'm not in charge. And yet, I'm so glad that I have this relationship with God, because He loves me so much. He loves me so much. He loves my family. And if I don't think I'm going to go anytime soon, but I'm really at peace. I'm really at peace with like whatever God has in store for us. And when I was drinking, all I cared about, that's what I was suffering from, was lack of peace of mind. And that the alcohol numbed me. And then having to make amends to people, and then to be of service, and you know, that 12th step is so critical for me. But today I work with others as vigorously as I worked with them when someone told me you're going to drink or you're going to die. And I'm so grateful for being an alcoholic, but I'm even more grateful for having the entire psychic change. Thank you.